Hallo og velkommen til denne episoden av Retro Crew på redcrew.net og gamer.no. Denne episoden er det Ketil som er programleder for, og han fikk tak i en spillutvikler fra tidligere spillselskapet Ocean, som nå er nedlagt, spillutgiveren fra Storbritannia. Vi satt oss ned i 40 minutter for å snakke med han. Dette er denne episoden, den er naturligvis på engelsk. Og så jeg vil bare forklare hva som var settinga her. Og da skal jeg ikke forstyrre noe mer. Det er det egentlig bare å sette i gang.
Alright, so today we're here with Mark R. Jones. He has been a graphics artist at Ocean Software between 1987 and 1991. Yeah. And he's been working on titles for the CX Spectrum, Amstrad, Atari ST and Commodore Amiga. And I think this includes various games for the Spectrum, like Conversion of Whistball, Grisor and Dragon Ninja. He's been doing some loading screens for Magmax and also been working on Mutants, Taipan, Arcanide 1 and 2, and the Spectrum Vindicator. And as I understand, he also did some Spectrum ST and Amiga license for Total Recall and ST and Amiga Rambo 3. So he's been, in the end, he was also working as a freelancer and contributed to Probe, including Last Battle for Elite, Alien 3, and Back to the Future 3. So during that period, he also co-designed the Mad Flood 2 for Bullfrog in 1992 before it was unfortunately cancelled. So that's a quite an impressive track record there. And I think our listeners also remember that we did an episode about Ocean some time ago. So we are very excited to have you here on the show, Mark.
It's a pleasure.
So was that a okay summary? Or
Yes, no, I was waiting for a mistake, but I didn't hear one.
Ah, nice. Good, good.
Wow.
I've been cross-checking. So I guess we just jump into the first question. So I heard you grew up in Northampton, so I was just wondering when you grew up there, when and how you were first introduced to computers and games, and how this computer graphics interest got the spark. How did that spark your interest?
Well, my cousin got a ZX81. I used to go and visit my cousin at the weekends because we got on really well, and he got himself a ZX81, and that was the very first time where something sort of... I got interested and wondered what these things could do. I remember playing Mazox around his by Don Priestley, wrote that. And then there was 3D Monster Maze. I remember playing that one.
Yeah.
And then he progressed to getting a Spectrum. And then a lot of my friends at school had got Spectrums, and that's when I started to get a bit more interested. Because obviously you had colour and you had sound. Better than these blocky graphics that I'd seen on the ZX81. So that's when I started to do a bit of homework. I went round a few friends' houses to see. I went round a friend, he had a Dragon 32.
Okay. Yeah.
Another friend had a VIC-20, and then I had another friend who had a Spectrum. So I was sort of, I must subconsciously doing some research to find out which one I should get.
Yeah.
And it was the Spectrum. It was easy to copy games. Everyone who had a Spectrum seemed to have a whole load of games.
Yeah.
So that was the one that I ended up badgering my mum and dad for.
Yeah, because I guess the market in, if you can compare Norway and UK, was a bit similar, because you know, here it was the home computer market that really took off with the Commodore 64, and I also know some people that had the Spectrum as well, but I think the Spectrum was even more popular over in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, there was a group of people who had Commodore 64s, but I wasn't friends with them. It just happened that the group of friends that I had, most of them had Spectrums. If my group of friends had Commodore 64s, then I probably would have got one of them instead.
Yeah. So was that kind of the first computer they had, or did they move from like Atari 2600 or something like that?
No, I don't remember recalling anybody having any console.
Okay.
Back then.
Yeah.
The people that I knew, they might have had a ZX81, but first computers were either the Spectrum or the Commodore. I didn't know anybody who had a console.
And did you have any experience with the arcades? Were arcades any big where you came from?
Yeah, well, before my cousin got his ZX81, we used to go outdoor swimming, a place called Binning Aquadrome. When we got a bit bored of, you know, lying by the pool, we'd go off and wander around the arcades. And I remember seeing Space Invaders and Mr. Do and Bomb Jack.
Yeah.
But I couldn't afford to put any money in them. My mum had given me 30p to go off with my cousin. And that went on blackjacks and fruit salads and sweets. So yeah. I watched them play arcade games. They looked too complicated for me, and I didn't want to waste my money on them.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they were designed for one thing, and that was to get money out of
exactly.
the kids' pockets.
I didn't have much.
Yeah. So I gather you got the Spectrum, and you got some software for that where you started on. Working on graphics and such?
Yeah, I was quite arty. At school, it was my favourite subject. And I thought, well, why don't I try and do some of these graphics and do them on the computer? So I think I got a copy of Melbourne Draw, which is what I started on. But then I started to earn a bit more money because I worked at the co-op and earned £10 a week. I used to save...
Oh, wow.
Exactly. 8 hours work, £10 a week.
Oh,
I saved up by 86. I'd saved up and bought the Artist 2 and Art Studio out of my own money. So I must have been getting pretty serious because I didn't know anybody. I mean, if I could have copied them off somebody, then I would have done, but I had to go out and buy them.
Mm.
So in order for me to have spent £15, I think they were about £15 each. And that was, you know, three weeks' wages for both of them. I must have been getting pretty serious. So I then progressed onto using them, and my early work is all just black and white line stuff. It's all a bit rubbish. Everyone's got to start somewhere. And then mid 86 I started experimenting with colour. All that old stuff still survives. It's all on the internet. And you can see that, you know, I got better and better, and then when I left school in 86, I started full-time at the computer shop where I'd been a Saturday lad after I'd finished at the co-op. So I became full-time there just because they needed staff and I didn't have a job. So I used to take the working that I'd done and load it up. And I think it was the boss, Graham, said to me one day, oh, you should, you know, send it off. And I mean, the thought hadn't even crossed my mind that I could do it for a living. And I thought, well, all right, then I tried. And I didn't know which companies had in-house developers and which houses didn't.
Mm.
I mean, I wrote to Piranha, I wrote to Mastertronic, and these were both companies that were just publishers.
Yeah.
They didn't have in-house teams, but there was no way of finding out who had in-house teams and who didn't, because there's no internet. You just, you know, I knew what I knew by reading in Crash, and if it wasn't in Crash or Sinclair User, then I didn't know it.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And then I ended up getting an interview at Elite and Ocean at the beginning of 87.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
So you didn't send an application to US Gold?
No, I knew. I think I'd got an idea that they were just... Because I worked in the computer shop,
ordered
off a company called Centresoft.
Okay,
Centresoft were linked to US Gold.
Right.
It was like the distribution part of US Gold, and I think I knew. Maybe I used to speak to Centresoft every day because they'd ring up for orders, and I think maybe somebody there might have told me that they didn't have any in-house jobs. I know that they used to. US Gold would have people like Platinum Productions working for them and Tier Text, and these were all out of house companies. I knew that US Gold was a publisher, so I didn't apply to them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they did some cooperation with Ocean in the beginning.
Yeah, the early Ocean Spectrum games, if you look on the inlays, I mean, for Christmas 1984, I got Blue Max by US Gold. My mum bought me that for Christmas.
Excellent game.
And then, the Spectrum version wasn't that good.
Okay.
But if you look the inlay, it says a Spectrum conversion by Ocean. Bruce Lee's another one, I think. One of the beachheads is. But there's quite a few Ocean games that are mentioned.
Yeah.
There's quite a few Ocean credits on early Ocean Spectrum conversions. Tapper was another one as well.
Oh yeah.
Oh nice. Tapper's cool.
That's a class game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I have Blue Max on the Atari 8-bit, and I think I saw Brotherbound logo on that.
Oh really?
Brotherbound. Yeah. Yeah. I guess. How do you pronounce that anyway?
They're the people who did Lode Runner, aren't they?
Prince of they published Prince of Persia, or I think so.
They may have done the conversion to the Atari. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. So you actually applied. You sent in some work that you had done to Ocean, and you went there for an interview, and you got a job.
Yes, it all happened very quickly. I had hoped that I could work at home, but Gary Bracey. Obviously he'd been brought in to stop the mess that had happened with the Street Hawk, Knight Rider, Highlander, It's a Knockout, all those dodgy titles that they were releasing in 1986. That happened because they didn't have enough in-house programmers to do all these games and licenses that they'd brought in, so they all went out of house. Nobody knew what was going on. So Gary was brought in to stop that from happening, and really they only wanted to employ people in house. So then I had to because I'd never considered moving to Manchester. So I remember getting a letter through the post saying that I was being offered a job, but I'd have to move to Manchester. And I remember my mum going, "Well, you're a homeboy," and I was like, "Well." and then I ended up giving it a go, obviously, so we wouldn't be here now talking about it. So, I took the plunge, and then I moved to Manchester, which was scary.
Was that back when they were Imagine, or were they called Ocean then, back in 86, 87?
No, they were Ocean, but they had acquired the Imagine label by then. So
yeah, okay.
It was, I knew that Imagine was not the Liverpool Imagine, because I'd seen commercial breaks. I remember watching that on TV. I'd just found it by accident and watched that and saw Imagine go bust. And I knew that Ocean had bought the name. But it was Ocean and Imagine back then, it was exactly the same. Same people promoting it, same people doing the artwork, same people making the games.
So you moved to Manchester and probably got a flat or something, and
the other Mark Jones who'd started about a couple of weeks before me.
Okay.
Mark K. Jones, and he was a Commodore and Amstrad artist.
Right.
He was working on Arkanoid 1 when I started on the Commodore 64, and he was looking for somewhere to live. So Mark K. Jones and Mark R. Jones ended up sharing a flat.
There's always a Mark Jones at home.
Yeah, exactly.
So
there was another Mark Jones. There's a Mark A. Jones as well, and he worked on worked at Activision for. He did R-Type and things like that.
Oh, nice!
I've never seen I don't know what he looks like. I've never seen him. Serious Mark Jones. I'm the one that's plastered all over the internet. He's the he hides himself away. I don't know what he looks like.
Yeah. And it's some of you guys that worked in the industry back then. It's very hard to get a hold of. I've gathered. I listened to some other podcasts as well where they review games and they always try to get hold of the developer, and sometimes it's just impossible, even though they know who he is.
Yeah, even some people who worked at Ocean, they just don't want to talk about it anymore.
Okay,
is there some bad blood or something? Is that why they don't want to talk about it, or?
I cannot say.
Sorry, yeah, of course. Of course, we can't go into everything, but...
No.
But what was it like in general working there? How long did you stay there and what was it like?
I was full time for just over 2 years. And then I left for a bit, and then I ended up working back there when I was roped in to help out with Total Recall, which was a total mess.
Right.
So then I ended up working in house 2 days a week and working at home for three. I was there full time for just over 2 years. It was good. Very relaxed. You know, they didn't moan if you were a... I mean, my first day, I was late. I was so nervous that I was on the top deck of a bus. I just had a massive big breakfast at the hotel. That people could smoke on buses back then. So the only place to sit was upstairs. And I remember having to get off early because I thought, because I was nervous, because I'd had a big breakfast, and because of the smoke. I remember I had to get off the bus early and it was late, and I thought I was going to get in trouble, but nobody cared. It didn't matter.
Okay.
Nice.
So, and I was all worried that I was going to get bollocks, told off.
Yeah.
And nobody said anything.
So it was a quite relaxed environment.
Yeah. I mean, I remember we got paid Friday dinner times, we'd get paid. And then people would just have, you know, 3 hour lunch hours. Everyone would get their wage slips. They'd get paid in cash on a Friday. Then everyone would go to the pub and there'd be no more work done. It'd be three and a half hour lunch break on a Friday, and then sit around reading magazines, having a talk, and then people would go home.
Yeah.
But the games got made, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've seen some of these posts on your Facebook page as well. See, you're always talking about that you're sitting down in this cellar.
Yeah.
Was the whole office underground? Or
yeah, the building, I mean, it's still there now, and it's still owned. The middle floor is still owned. Well, the whole building's owned by the Quakers, which is a religious group.
Oh, okay.
But the building's too big for them. So when Ocean was there, the Quakers had the middle floor. David Ward, John Woods, Colin Stokes, and the art department, and all the sales girls were upstairs in the posh offices.
Mm-hmm.
We were all down in the cellars.
Oh, okay. So the people that did the real work were stuffed down in the cellar.
Exactly. We were pushed out the way. No windows. Well, there were small windows, but they looked out onto people's feet.
Yeah.
They were very high anyway, so we couldn't look out. No natural light, but it was good. It was good. It was fine. It was a nice place to work.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
So, as I understand from one of the interviews that was posted online, your first project that you were involved in was a game called Mag Max for the Spectrum.
Yeah. I'd heard of that. This was one of these games that had been advertised for ages throughout 86 and hadn't surfaced yet, because as I said before, this one was it was sourced out of house. I mean, they'd given it to the bloke who'd written Knight Rider.
Okay.
So he'd written Knight Rider, which was an abysmal, and yet he'd still got another game. I don't understand. They'd given him another game to do after that. But I remember that the graphics on the Spectrum version weren't they weren't defined very well. So I remember being asked to redefine the main characters. And I had a letter from the programmer just explaining how big they were supposed to be. And then he was just asked to do a loading screen to finish it off.
Okay.
As it was my first proper loading screen, and it was going to go out on a game and it was going to be on the shelves.
Yeah.
Up to then, it was the best work I'd ever done, because I had to impress everybody, didn't I?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I had Ronnie Fowles and all the people who'd been writing Ocean games that I'd been playing looking over my shoulder, watching what I was doing. So I had to do something good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it turned out all right.
Yeah. And maybe you can explain to our listeners a little bit about this loader screen, or ocean loader, that's so famous. What's that?
Well, the ocean loader that's so famous is on the Commodore 64, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where they play music while it's loading in.
Hmm.
So but it wasn't a loading screen would be there, wouldn't it? So that you would have something to look at while the game loaded in, instead of just a blank screen. And I used to love looking at people's loading screens when I was playing games when I was a kid. It was all part of the atmosphere, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it would make the loading a bit longer, not that much longer, but I much prefer to have to look at a lovely loading screen than stare at a blank screen. So you'd have a screen that would illustrate, that would come up on the screen. Normally, 9 times out of 10, it'd be a computer version of the advert or you know, the game artwork. And there's some brilliant loading screens that were made.
So there's not an equivalent for the Spectrum. It's the
loader.
Yeah.
Well, no, The loader that was done for the Spectrum was to stop, was to A, to make it far, to make it loading quicker, and to make it hard to copy.
Okay.
Right.
We never had the privilege of loading music. It was something that the Spectrum didn't do.
I noticed that a lot of people have put probably all of the, I think all of the Ocean loaders are on, Commodore 64 loaders are on YouTube now.
Yeah, see, I'd completely forgotten about the Ocean loaders. But then when I heard one, I hadn't heard one for about 15, 20 years, and then when I heard one again, I was transported back to 6 Central Street. I'd heard them all the while you were sitting there doing your graphics, because people would be playtesting games.
Yeah.
I was sitting in the room just up from where Martin Galway used to work and where Jonathan Dunn used to work. The games testers would be testing. They'd also have to test faulty games that were sent back.
Okay.
So people would send, this game doesn't work, and it would get sent back and it would get tested. Mm-hmm. So all these tunes that are on the different Ocean loaders were still all in my head. And okay. So I hunted them all down because I wanted to hear them all again.
Yeah. And the first full game that you were involved in was the Spectrum conversion of the excellent game Whistball.
Yeah, excellent on the Commodore 64.
Yeah, but you weren't too happy with some aspect of the Spectrum version. How's that?
No. Well, it's a miracle that there's a Spectrum version at all. It's just that the programmer disappeared one day when it was half finished.
Oh, okay.
And it had to be finished off by somebody else. When Whizball was being written by Sensible Software, they'd come in every couple of weeks, bring a new version in. I'd load it up on the Commodore 64 next to me and copy all the graphics onto the Spectrum. So everything that was in the Commodore version was done on the Spectrum. Like, you had the cop, you had the yin and yang. Whizball, when he was invincible originally, I'm not sure if that happens on the Commodore 64 version actually, but when you became invincible, the Whizball turned into a spinning yin and yang.
Yeah.
So that was all done. All the graphics for the bonus section were done. The graphics were done properly for the Wizard's Lair. But then when you look at the Spectrum version, it's half of it's missing.
Yeah, okay.
Wow.
So I'd done all that work. It was my first game, and then it got released. As far as I was concerned, it wasn't finished.
Okay. Mm.
Was that machine difficult to program for, or?
Ask a programmer. Yeah. I haven't got a clue. I've read these how-to-machine code books, and it just goes over my head.
Yeah, because I get the feeling that everything back then was pretty hard, to be honest.
Well, I remember that Spectrum games were programmed on Tandy's TRS something.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah.
Tatung Einsteins, that was it.
Oh,
They used Tatung Einsteins to program on, and then it would be squirted down into the Spectrum, and then, you know, when they wanted to run something and see if it would work. Because I know before they got the Tatungs, they were using micro drives, and everybody lost so much work it wasn't worth it. So they used Tatung Einsteins. But as to how hard it is, to me, programming the Spectrum is impossible. I have no idea how it's done. It's way over my head.
Same here then.
I still don't understand how it's done.
Nice. So,
no idea.
But you probably know, you can talk a little bit about how the process was to do the graphics on the Spectrum. You know, which software did you use, and how did you collaborate with the developer programmer?
I was sat next to the programmer, so he would go, right, Whizball, do the main character 2x2, so it was 4 characters. Leave a gap around the edge for the mask, because on the Spectrums you had to do a mask.
Okay.
Which was like an inverted version of the graphic, so that it wouldn't merge with other graphics.
Yeah.
And you've got this many frames to do it in. And so I just sit there and use Melbourne Draw. Mike Lamb, who wrote, he did the Arkanoid versions of, he did Spectrum versions of Arkanoid, Arkanoid 2, RoboCop, Batman the Movie, lots of Spectrum games, added some stuff on to Melbourne Draw that let you animate. I think actually no, Joffre and Paul Owens added the animation capabilities so you could animate graphics, and then Mike Lamb, he added a map editor which he needed to use when he did Renegade and Target Renegade.
Ah, okay.
So we had this beef up version of Melbourne Draw called Ocean Draw.
Okay.
That had all these extra facilities that Melbourne Draw didn't have. So it was an in-house thing. Obviously, for loading screens, we would use all different programs. I remember you perhaps do part of it on Melbourne Draw, then you'd go to the Artist 2 because it had a better feature than the Art Studio. Mm. So it's a good thing about, you know, a Spectrum screen could be loaded into any Spectrum editor, and you just use the best parts of each editor to do what you wanted it to do. So we used quite a few different things.
Yeah. So does the Spectrum have a lot of like built-in sprites?
No, it's got nothing like that.
Okay.
No.
Right, so there's nothing like a typical, like a console would have, that they had a chip with a lot of sprites.
No, nothing. No. No, the Spectrum didn't have anything like that at all. No. As far as I know. But yeah. Again, I'm not a programmer.
No.
never will be.
No.
Yeah, none of us are programmers either, but maybe, Kettle, you've...
You know, if I could program, I'd be doing my own little Spectrum games. But unfortunately, it's way over my head. So, I mean, I did Dingo. I did a new Spectrum game a couple of years ago, which was an ACG arcade game before they were Ultimate that had been forgotten about. So we put Dingo onto the Spectrum, and that was good fun. But I haven't got a clue how to program it. So I did all the graphics, did the music, and it was good fun actually. I never thought I'd do another Spectrum game again.
Yeah.
But cool. Yeah, no idea how to program.
But you say this mask that you kind of took around the character, is that because the this color problem on the Spectrum, that the color wouldn't
be? It would just be, if you had a graphic pass over background without a mask, then it would be like they were see through.
Yeah. Oh.
Whereas if you get a graphic that passes on a Spectrum, if you've got a graphic that passes in front of something and it covers up what it's behind, then it's got a mask, and you need to do a mask, otherwise everything merges into everything else and turns into a horrible gobbly mess.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice.
And when did you move to working on the 16-bit machines like the Amiga and Atari ST?
That was the end part of 88.
I thought you were about to say that was the other Mark.
I was really scared. Because on the Spectrum, you didn't have to bother with colouring things in.
Mm.
And then going onto an Amiga and ST from a Spectrum, it was quite hard at first.
Yeah.
You had to get used to and got a clue what anti-aliasing was. You didn't have to do that on the Spectrum. It was just you either had a block on or a block off, and then you decided what the colour, the eight character square.
Yeah.
You just had to decide what colour the character square was. Mm. And then when you moved onto the Amiga and ST, it was like more like you were painting things.
Yeah.
So everything took a lot longer to do, and I hadn't had any experience of colouring things in.
Right.
It was hard, but I did it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying anything I did on the Amiga and ST was brilliant, but you know, it got published.
Yeah. So you didn't enjoy it as much as the Spectrum games.
Well, no. You see, I'd had 4 years of getting used to the Spectrum, and then to be told, "Oh, your next project's on the ST," and then you're like, "Oh, because you got to learn to use a new editor," and then you're starting from scratch again, really. So it was quite scary for me, quite stressful.
And did that was there a shift as well in how you were organized then, since it was a more advanced machines and you needed more people to do the games?
Yeah, I mean, when you did a Spectrum game, there was three people: artist, programmer, a musician. But then I remember when we did Rambo 3, we all had a section each. I remember that Ivan Deacon did the gauntlet type section, and I was given the 3D tank section. And that was, I mean, not only did I have more colours to get to look right, I ended up having to draw everything, you know, eight times as it got bigger.
Mm.
I mean, there was no way of drawing one thing and then shrinking it and making it grow bigger just software-wise. You had to actually draw each different So I had it when it was further away. I had to draw it running when he was furthest away, then a bit closer and draw him running again, then a bit closer to drawing him, then again. It was very monotonous.
Oh, sounds really tedious.
No, it was very tedious.
And but you're mentioning some of something that Ocean was kind of famous, and or they were known to have all these that they bought all these TV and movie licenses.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting strategy to do that, and even though that a lot of these movie maybe didn't get great reviews, at least the ones that you bought in the beginning. So, do you know anything why they moved in that direction, or how why did they choose that strategy?
Because whenever they released a game that people knew about already, be it a film or had Daley Thompson on it, sold bucket loads more than a game that didn't.
Yeah,
right.
You know, Whizball on the 64 is, you know, supposed to be one of the best 64 games of all time, and I really like it, but it didn't sell as much as a game with a license on it.
Yeah.
Then you've got, you know, David Ward and John Woods upstairs were businessmen. So if they what are they going to do? If people are going out and buying in bucket loads games with licenses on them, what are they going to do? Release games with licenses on them, or games like Whizball that haven't got a license on them?
Yeah.
They don't sell as much. They're going to release the licenses, aren't they? Because they make more money. David and John were there to make money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if people didn't want licensed games, then they shouldn't have gone out in their hundreds and thousands and bought them.
Yeah. So these games sold even though that maybe the movies were kind of poor B 80s action.
I mean, RoboCop was a great film.
Yeah, I like
RoboCop. Oh, and that's a really good. I think that's a good game. I quite like.
Yeah,
that
I
game.
Like RoboCop, and like Batman the movie, and also Total Recall is also a good movie. I like that.
Hang on. What was the question?
Kettle, what was the question?
I don't think there was a question in there. Anyway,
no, we just said that the RoboCop game I have quite fond memories of, really, because I think I've played it on multiple platforms too.
Well, that was their biggest ever selling game by then.
Oh yeah, I can believe that.
Before that, they'd had a massive success with Daley Thompson's Decathlon.
Yeah.
You know, all the games that they released before that, they probably didn't sell many. You know, what did they have before that? Pogo, Cavalon,
right.
Kong. Hunchback.
Yeah.
Hunchback. As soon as they released Daley Thompson's Decathlon, that's the one that went massive for them for the first time.
Yeah. I think everyone remembers a lot of things about Ocean, but especially the company logo is an extremely recognizable, almost like an iconic logo.
It's a lovely logo, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Beautiful. Yeah.
So of course they were in the Ocean. The company was at its prime in the 80s and early 90s. And were they bought by Infogrames in 96 or something?
Yes, that's what happened.
Yeah,
Infogrames bought them. I'd left by then.
Yeah,
Infogrames bought them, and then the whole structure of Ocean changed. Lots of people left. And then I think within a year, I think they'd shut it down. I think it was 98. 98 was... Ocean releases were Impossible... Was it Impossible Mission? Impossible Mission or Wet Tricks on the N64. Nobody seems to be really sure which one it was.
Okay,
but
yeah.
It didn't last long.
So do you have any thoughts on why they couldn't cope with this market shift to the next generation consoles like the PlayStation?
I don't think they were prepared for how long it took to make a game. How many are on the PS1 or whatever machines they were working on then? Ocean were obviously used to having, you know, perhaps a 3-month turnaround on a game, or, you know, 6 months maybe. These PS games and SNES games took so much longer and involve more people as well, they did try to expand. I know they moved to different when they moved from 6 Central Street and went to a different premises in Castlefield, still in Manchester. But I think there was they were there was a long periods of time where they didn't have any product out. Now that's just me speaking from what I've heard from other people, but I don't think they hadn't prepared for that.
Yeah.
And that's when David and John decided to get out, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's just a bit interesting because a lot of these, you know, companies started to disappear around then. And I guess it's just a couple that survived, or they were kind of acquired, but they kept the name, like Psygnosis. And
touched on in the film documentary Bedrooms to Billions.
Yeah.
Mm.
How all the English companies started to disappear because they weren't prepared for the high development costs for these console games, because they were so, you know, they were used to doing, for taking 6 months to do a game. And then, I mean, I remember a lot of Ocean games back then got canned. I remember there was Universal Monsters that people had been working on for a good, you know, year or whatever it was, and then it got cancelled.
Mm.
So you've got a big team of people working on a game and then it doesn't get released.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Totally.
So you were staying, how are we on time now?
We're just about there, I think, time-wise.
We're getting a couple of questions, and then we can wrap up.
Yep.
Okay.
So this question you probably get all the time, but just have to ask it anyway. Your favorite game of all time, what's that?
I think it's going to have to be Boulder Dash.
Boulder Dash.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
Right.
On any machine, whether it be on the 64 or on the Spectrum, not a 16-bit one. The 16-bit versions were rubbish.
Yeah.
Give me the Spectrum version or Commodore 64 version of Boulder Dash and I'm happy for a good hour.
Yeah. Yeah, I do remember that a couple of games did not have a good transition from the 8-bit machines to the 16-bit machines. Like,
no, there was a lot of. If you look back at some of them early Amiga and ST games, there was a lot of rubbish.
Yeah,
mm.
You know, I'm a big fan of the game Karateka by Jordan Mechner.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was really good on the Atari 8-bit, but they also did a conversion for the Atari ST, which was really rubbish.
So. Well, even like the ST and Amiga versions of Whizball. I mean, back then, we thought, though, oh, they look really pretty. I remember Peter Johnson coming in and bringing them in. Mm. But compare it, when you play it now and compare it to the Commodore 64 version, it's nowhere near as good as the 64 version.
Yep.
It's like there's something missing.
Yeah, I remember I had a huge fight with one of my friends. He still had the Commodore 64 and I'd gotten the Amiga, and we were fighting over which was the best version of the Guiana Sisters.
Which one was it then?
I thought the Amiga, and he thought the Commodore 64. So
yeah,
you still think that now, though?
Yeah, I do. interesting that game became so popular, by the way, since it was pulled so quickly due to this copyright problem, or the Nintendo
shelves
issue.
Very fast, didn't
they?
Yeah.
I mean, the Spectrum versions disappeared. The 64 version, you can play that, can't you?
Yeah.
And the Amiga?
Yes.
Yeah, but there was a Spectrum version, but that's disappeared. That's not surfaced.
Oh, okay. Hmm. So there's no image online or anything.
Oh, it was reviewed. There are images, but a copy of it has not surfaced yet.
Okay, so we can't get hold of the ROM. Hmm.
Yeah,
interesting.
You can't play that.
Okay. Lastly, so you, as I understand, you're a bit involved in the retro scene today as well. You're participating in events like Revival in Wolverhampton, I saw, and the
Ocean Book.
The Ocean Book, yeah, by Chris Wilkins.
And the Spectrum Book from Chris Wilkins. We've just that's been very well received.
Yeah.
One of the things I do is restore old games artwork.
Hmm.
So
cool.
I started by helping Bob Wakelin out because he lost a lot of his artwork. There's a story that he tells where he was rung up by someone in the warehouse and they said, Bob, they're throwing all your artwork away. Come down and get as much as you can. And some of it was on the floor and some of it had been trodden on, but he saved what he could. But there was quite a few bits that he didn't save. And I kept all my stuff from when I was at Ocean, and I had a few posters of artwork that he didn't have. So a couple of years ago, I think we managed to save about 11 or 12 of his artworks that he didn't have originals of. So that's something that I like doing, is restoring old games artwork and tidying it up and getting rid of all the errant print dots and stuff. It's very time consuming but relaxing.
So you're saving this from old diskettes?
Yeah. Magazines.
Okay, magazines. Yeah, okay.
It lays a lot of that stuff. If you look on the net, it's very ropey. So I'm trying to, you know, clean stuff up. I've just cleaned up Ollie Frey's Turn Our Nug map that was released in Crash. Because again, it was all the versions on the internet were ropey. Mm. So I enjoy, you know, scanning them in, cleaning them up, and preserving them.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw on Twitter that you had also contributed to AtariMania.com with some...
See, I'd found some ST discs when we were going to do Flood 2. I had all my games design and stuff, and I still had my graphics that had been done for it, that had been made for it. And we had a few demos, so that was all sent off and preserved. I had a demo of Rambo 3. That I didn't even know I had. I'd stuck it behind the tray in the box.
Huh.
There was an early version of Rambo 3 that you could just select what level you wanted to play, and the high school tackle had silly things written in it and stuff. So
awesome.
I still keep finding things.
Nice. Yeah, there's a lot of interest, as you said yourself as well. So it's good that you're taking
the Ocean
time.
The Ocean Facebook page has been amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got nearly 2,500 likes, I think. Which for one company is really good.
It is.
And people love all that stuff, so I'm glad that I saved it, because many times I was told to throw it away.
You should never do that. Before.
Yeah, I remember back in the...
No, it will come in use someday, and
yep,
it has.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when the PCs were taking over everything, and people getting rid of all their Amiga, Commodore, and old console stuff, and I think a lot of those people are,
I had an Amiga, loads of games, loads of original games, loads of copies, and I sold it all to a lad up the road. I wish I'd kept it. It could be sitting in someone's attic now, for all I know, sitting there rotting away my entire collection.
Yeah.
I've had to rebuy everything, so I've got most of my old stuff back, except for Hybris and Battle Squadron. Too expensive.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Two of my best favourite shoot 'em ups, Hybris and Battle Squadron, and I had originals of them, but I'm not paying 70 quid.
No, that's... I think the prices on eBay are crazy these days with some of this stuff.
I mean, I bought my Conker's Bad Fur Day on the N64 for 33 quid.
Yeah.
And now you can't get a cartridge for less than 80.
No.
Oh, wow.
I mean, mine's boxed and complete. They're going for 200 plus now, and I got it for 33 quid. So it's crazy.
Jeez.
Yeah. So I saw that in this interview, I think I read it was from 2011, that you'd worked on some retro-style game for iOS.
Oh, that fell through.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was the first thing that I was going to do. And the bloke who was programming it used to play my games when he was a kid.
Oh, wow.
But it didn't happen. It didn't happen. The first thing I did retro-related was Dingo on the Spectrum.
Hmm.
And I did the artwork, and we made 70 copies and sold them at the replay expo that was up in Blackpool.
Yep.
And that went really well. I mean, I've been in more magazines in the last 5 years than I ever was in the 80s. I only had my face in a magazine once in the 80s, and that was Spanish one.
Okay.
Famous group. There's a group photograph of us all standing on the steps outside at Ocean, and that was printed in a Spanish magazine. And that was the only time I was ever in a magazine back then. But last 5 years, I've been 10, 12 times in magazines now.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, it is a really, really huge interest.
Very bizarre.
Yeah.
Cool.
Awesome. Okay, I think we're done then.
Yeah, that about wraps it up, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I hope that was all right.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was very good. Thanks a lot. It was very interesting.
Take care. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.